Gunmen in the Philippines have shot dead a Roman Catholic bishop on the southern island of Jolo. The bishop, Benjamin de Jesus, was shot in the head outside his cathedral. The attackers have not been identified and no motive has been established. Rebels fighting the Zairean army have taken the town of Kelemi in the copper-rich southern province of Shaba. It means the strip of territory they control along the eastern side of Zaire is now more than 1,000 kilometers long. The Colombian army has been sending reinforcements to a jungle area near the capital Bogota, where government troops have been involved in heavy fighting since being ambushed by left-wing guerrillas on Saturday. The Peruvian president, Alberto Fujimori, has confirmed that he's asked a number of countries if they would offer asylum to the guerrillas holding hostages in Lima. The Turkish government has protested to the Iranian ambassador to Ankara over a call he made for the introduction of Sharia law in Turkey. His remarks led to complaints from secular groups in the country. The United States has joined international criticism of the violent tactics used by Serbian riot police against opposition demonstrators in Belgrade. It said the actions of the police would only further isolate Serbia. And that's the summary.
For the Pakistan Muslim League of Nawaz Sharif, the election is turning out far better than expected. For the former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, the leader of the Pakistan People's Party, it's been another political humiliation. But the turnout of voters in this election has been low. Let's go first to Lahore, the headquarters of the Muslim League. Our correspondent Daniel Lack spent much of the night there amid the party atmosphere at the Nawaz Sharif residence.
Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif! Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif!
Ecstatic supporters gathered early and stayed late to celebrate apparent victory at Nawaz Sharif's family home. The celebrants were mostly young men, but the crowd included older men, women, and children. All were overjoyed with their party's performance, including, of course, Nawaz Sharif himself.
We feel very satisfied that the response of the people is very good, very encouraging. That response now has translated into seats. We are getting very good news from all over the country.
Counting ballots at a polling station in eastern Lahore. The clear winner is Nawaz Sharif's Muslim League. The party leader with the most to lose, Benazir Bhutto, has already said the entire vote was rigged. Foreign and local election monitors disagree. IA Rahman of the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan.
No, that has not taken place. We have not heard of anything like that at the moment. But the frequent changes in the election law, which have affected certain candidates and certain parties in particular, did not prepare the pitch, as they say, for a fair election.
Turnout is mostly lower than usual, but still respectable in many areas. Shabazz Sharif, the brother of Nawaz, has political and practical explanations for why the voters may have stayed home.
Don't forget we are in the month of Ramadan, and that is one factor. But anyway, I think our vote bank is quite intact. It's People's Party voter very disappointed, and they're the one who did not turn out today to vote for their candidate, and that's it. We have no problems. I think it's a very satisfactory result.
Problems with turnout and allegations of fraud aside, Pakistanis still don't seem convinced of the importance of these elections, their fourth trip to the polls in 8 years. IA Rahman explains the apathy.
For two decades, we have been trying to find a shortcut. The government doesn't function. We dismiss it. We elect a new government. It doesn't function. We dismiss it again. And we do not attend to the very basic issues. The very basic issues are that Pakistan's administration is 150 years old. It cannot meet the requirements of a modern society.
For now, it's time for Nawaz Sharif supporters to celebrate. But his election is just the beginning of his challenges. The high expectations of his supporters, a worsening economy, and general law and order problems need to be addressed quickly if the cheers are not to give way to grief as a nation unravels.
Daniel Lack reporting from Lahore. Now, what about the former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto? Ali Ahmed of the BBC Urdu service is in her home constituency of Lakhana in Sindh.
Benazir has summoned a meeting of her central committee of her party along with the member of the dismissed cabinet, and then she will decide what action to take in the light of these results, because she is definitely not convinced that these results show a clear majority for Nawaz Sharif. She thinks that the elections have been rigged and the people have been deceived, and she feels rather a bit shocked and traumatized.
The BBC's Ali Ahmed. Well, traumatized she may be, but what will the PPP do? Sadar Salim is a party official in Islamabad.
The People's Party is not going to accept the result of this election, which is very clearly, visibly rigged. We have certain proofs for rigging. For instance, people have seen the polling throughout the day. The turnout, which is shown on the official result, was not on the ground.
However, Sartash Aziz of the Muslim League dismisses this as another attack of sour grapes.
Whenever they have lost the election, they always say it is rigged. When they win election, it's all right. So that is not very democratic or very civilized.
The former Test cricketer Imran Khan and his new party, the Movement for Justice, was contesting 150 of the 217 National Assembly seats, but has made no impact at all. Another of our correspondents in Pakistan, Richard Galpin, examines the reasons for Imran Khan's poor showing.
Despite being a total stranger to politics, Imran Khan believed he offered the electorate a genuine alternative to the two mainstream parties. His message was simple, that the only way for Pakistan to move forward was to tackle the corruption at the heart of the political establishment. He promised radical solutions, for example, threatening to execute anyone found guilty of corrupt practices. But despite the hype, particularly by the Western media, it all seems to have come to nothing. So far, not only has he failed to win a single seat, but his party has only secured a handful of votes across the country. Before the polling stations had closed on Monday, one of his campaign managers, Hassan Rashid, was making excuses.
The problems have been, we were a young party, we were not fully organized, we don't have enough organizations around the country. We were in the process of setting them up when the elections came. I think it was very brave of Imran to go into the elections without proper preparation and without any resources.
Whilst much of this is true, the question now is whether the party will sink without trace or whether it'll survive and learn from this first painful test at the polls to develop into a genuine third force in Pakistani politics. There are many who believe that Imran Khan is simply too naive to become a serious politician, and that he'll always be handicapped by allegations about his earlier reputation as a playboy. But without doubt, Imran Khan must know he has a very long way to go before breaking through into the political mainstream.
Richard Galpin reporting. The actual voter turnout is still not clear. When early reports said it could have been as low as one quarter of the electorate, it prompted this response from the former Australian Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser, who's head of the Commonwealth Observer Group.
We've been told by many people throughout the country that they don't have great respect for their politicians, they don't have great respect for the way they behave, or for the way democracy works. And this low vote should be taken as a very significant warning by all the political parties, because unless Pakistan's political culture changes, I believe the future of Pakistan's democracy will be very much in doubt.
Malcolm Fraser. Abbas Nasir of the BBC Urdu service is in Islamabad. A short while ago, I asked him for the latest news of the results.
With about half the official results in, Nawaz Sharif, out of the 102 declared results, his party's got 74, which is two more than it won in the entire election last time round, which was in 1993. However, let me take you back to those comments by Shahbaz Sharif and then by the head of the Commonwealth Observers Group. The turnout figures really fast becoming the bone of contention here. President Farooq Laghari said that the turnout figure, according to his information, was 26% to 27% in Punjab and Sindh. And in Punjab, where Nawaz Sharif's party has routed the opposition almost completely, most of the results that have since been announced show an average turnout figure of 40%. And surely Nawaz Sharif's opponents are going to sort of jump the gun where this apparent discrepancy is concerned.
So I suppose the most interesting thing will be what Benazir Bhutto makes of it all.
Absolutely. She's leaving her ancestral home and her constituency of Larkana, and she's heading towards Islamabad. She is planning to hold a meeting of her party central executive committee, and she'll definitely talk to the press either before or after, and it'll be very, very interesting. Although Nawaz Sharif seems to have won decisively his victory, to not only his opponents but to some sort of observers also, is a bit too emphatic.
He, of course, is returning to office. This time he's promised a clean, honest government. Is there going to be real change, do you think? Has Pakistan turned a corner?
I mean, it's very, very difficult to say. But yes, in as much as his freedom of action to do anything is concerned, it will be greatly reduced and restricted. On the one hand, will be a very powerful president armed with a Supreme Court decision in his favor to dissolve assemblies. On the other, a Council for National Security, where the top brass of the military will advise him, as is being officially said, on issues of prime national importance.
But this disillusionment on the part of the electorate is difficult to exaggerate. I mean, they really have shown it in the voter turnout, haven't they?
That's the thing. Last time round, nobody mentioned the word apathy, and the turnout was about 40%. This time round, we saw that the polling stations weren't sort of registering a more than 26-27%, to the point that the President of Pakistan said so himself. But the final result, wherever PML Nawaz Sharif group has won, is quite clearly a turnout of 40% or thereabouts, you know, going up to 58 in one case and 33 in the other.
The BBC's Abbas Nasir in Islamabad. You're listening to Newsday in the World Service of the BBC. Close to the Colombian capital, Bogota, reinforcements are being airlifted in to support army units suffering heavy losses in combat with command units of the country's main guerrilla army. It's been confirmed that at least 19 soldiers have been killed, two helicopters have been damaged by anti-aircraft fire, while a whole infantry platoon is missing in action. From Bogota, Timothy Ross reports.
Government troops were following intelligence reports that in the San Juanito Hills, only 70 miles from the capital, were headquartered leaders of the Colombian Armed Revolutionary Forces, the FARC. As they moved in, they were ambushed repeatedly with machine guns, rockets, mortars, mines, and lethal sniper fire. They had run straight into elite FARC fighters protecting their commanders. The first two Black Hawk helicopters flying in reinforcements were damaged by hails of anti-aircraft fire and turned back. One soldier on board was killed and two wounded. Army sources say at least 19 men have died in 2 days of non-stop fighting. But when the brigade commander was asked about reports that the number of dead could already be over 25, he refused to confirm or deny the figures. Companies of reinforcements are being flown in, but although some new helicopters have recently been purchased abroad, the Colombian military are still desperately short of troop transports and protective gunships. They are receiving sporadic support from Air Force ground attack jets and a bomber, harassing suspected rebel positions. The jungle-covered mountainsides are ideal guerrilla terrain, and somewhere in the area, one unit of soldiers has disappeared. It's feared the lost platoon may have been wiped out or taken prisoner. Skirmishes and bomb attacks are reported from other parts of the country, and despite over 40 years' experience of counterinsurgency, the Colombian army is still steadily losing ground to the guerrillas.
Timothy Ross in Bogota. Zaire is looking for more help to stop the rebel advance in the east of the country. Reports from the capital, Kinshasa, suggest that Morocco, Togo and Chad are all prepared to send troops to Zaire to support President Mobutu. The government has already begun a counter-offensive to regain lost territory. But the rebels, who, according to Kinshasa, have the backing of Uganda, Rwanda and Burundi, say they've now advanced southwards to capture the town of Kalemi in Shaba province. I asked our correspondent in Kinshasa, William Wallace, what was known about the arrival of foreign troops to back up the Zairean army.
Well, it's something that's been rumoured in Kinshasa for a little while, and it's something that a senior official at the Defence Ministry now confirms. He says that the planes to bring these troops in have already been chartered, and that Morocco, Chad and Togo are indeed prepared to send some troops into Zaire. However, the Defence Ministry is unable to say how many troops are prepared to come in and when they will arrive, if indeed they do arrive.
In the meantime, what's known about the presence of foreign mercenaries in Zaire?
Even the defense ministry itself is no longer denying that they're here. In fact, a town right up in the northern part of Upper Zaire called Watsa, the defense ministry says the airport there is essentially defended by foreign mercenaries. I myself have seen at least 15 of the mercenaries in the town of Kisangani in recent weeks. So I think Zaire no longer really denies that mercenaries are here, nor denies that they're playing quite a crucial role at present in defending an airstrip which may prove vital to them if they manage to keep it.
Now, the rebels say they've moved further southwards, taking the town of Kelemi, penetrating the province of Shaba for the first time. Does this signify that the government's counteroffensive has been halted, do you think?
In going further south, the rebels may have slightly thwarted government plans, because I think the government plans were to head east and to try and attack from the north. But the fact that the rebels have actually advanced some considerable distance to the south and indeed actually taken, as they claim, a major town in the province of Shaba does indeed have a symbolically dampening effect on the whole concept of a government counteroffensive. Kelemi, the defense ministry here, says is still disputed. They say that soldiers are still battling to hold the town, but a lot of other reports coming from both Kinshasa and from sources generally in the region suggest that Kelemi has already fallen.
William Wallace in Kinshasa. After nearly 10 weeks of street protests, the opposition in Serbia is now calling for a campaign of civil disobedience. There was another confrontation between police and protesters in Belgrade on Monday, but no repetition of the violence that occurred on Sunday night when about 60 people were injured. The demonstrators want the full reinstatement of the local election victories, which were annulled by the government. The deadline for the convening of a new Belgrade assembly runs out today. But the Serbian opposition leader, Vuk Drašković, has appealed for calm and says the evening rallies are to end.
Yes, although it's been brilliant that people have streamed from different parts of the city to Freedom Square, under the present conditions of police terror and the curfew imposed in Serbia, citizens must not run the risk of becoming easy victims for Milosevic's bandits.
So is this a change of tactics by the Serbian opposition? Our correspondent in Belgrade, Paul Wood.
The opposition are really feeling quite pleased about Monday's events. They got a very good turnout. Tens of thousands of people came out, despite the violence of the night before when tear gas and water cannon was used, and despite a very heavy and intimidating police presence. They're quite worried, though, about what the next 24 hours will bring. They are increasingly convinced that President Milosevic intends to impose some sort of direct rule on Belgrade, perhaps even to declare a state of emergency.
We heard from Vuk Drašković saying that the demonstrators shouldn't become the easy victims of Mr. Milosevic's bandits. How concerned is the opposition to contain the violence and not to get sucked into an escalation?
This was classic rhetoric from an opposition leader who's very good at really catching the moment, Vuk Drašković. There is an element of seriousness here. There have been serious clashes. Nobody wants to see more injuries. Also, the strategy is not to get drawn in, as you say, to clashes with the police. They feel this is exactly what President Milosevic wants. If there's widespread disorder on the streets, he has the perfect reason to declare, the argument goes, a state of emergency. That would solve the problems of the street protest. It would end it at a stroke. Would also perhaps solve the problems of the opposition's seeming victories in a string of councils across the country, including Belgrade. It would allow him to impose the direct rule, which many people believe is the ultimate aim of the strategy now, of waiting until the opposition just gets exhausted on the streets.
And yet at the same time, of course, the international community does not want to see more violence on the streets of Belgrade and must surely be putting more and more pressure on Mr. Milosevic.
There's a rising chorus of international condemnation, some very harsh words for Belgrade. I don't think, though, that President Milosevic is listening any longer. Certainly that's the import of what's been happening on the streets over the past 48 hours.
Our Belgrade correspondent, Paul Wood. Still to come on Newsday, the big move in Germany as the government prepares to relocate to Berlin. A reminder of our top story. Results so far from the general election in Pakistan show that the Muslim League is heading for a comfortable victory, with its leader, Nawaz Sharif, set to become Prime Minister for a second time. With about half the results in, the BBC Islamabad correspondent says there are indications that the Muslim League's victory could be a landslide. He says the Pakistan People's Party of the ousted Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto is facing a humiliating defeat, one of its worst ever. Gunmen in the Philippines have shot dead a Roman Catholic bishop outside his cathedral on the southern island of Jolo. It's not yet clear who carried out the attack. On the line to Manila, I asked the BBC's John McLean what was known about the killing.
Well, it appears that the killing took place early this morning. Two gunmen walked up to Bishop Benjamin de Jesus as he was getting out of his jeep in front of the cathedral. One of them pulled out a gun, shot him in the head. The bishop was killed instantly. The gunmen themselves escaped on foot.
This is a very volatile area, but nonetheless a particularly shocking incident.
Indeed, yes. Killings such as this of a senior figure in the Roman Catholic Church are extremely rare, even for the southern Philippines, where for many years the Muslim minority has been fighting for independence. There is a theory that the gunman might have been trying to abduct the bishop, but that's only a theory at the moment. Several Muslim separatist groups have resorted to things like kidnapping in order to raise funds as their political campaign runs out of steam.
So what line of inquiry are the authorities likely to pursue?
This is purely speculation, but it seems that the finger of suspicion will fall on one of a number of Muslim groups still operating in the area. The main candidate is probably the Abu Sayyaf group, which is notorious for some particularly vicious killings in that part of the Philippines, as well as abductions and other outrages.
Now, the government signed a peace deal with the rebels last year, but not all of them. Can you remind us of the situation?
Indeed, yes. The government signed a peace deal with the Moro National Liberation Front, which was the main movement seeking independence or at least autonomy for the Muslims in the southern Philippines. That, however, has left a number of other groups who are still outside the fold. In some cases, these groups still have political purposes. In other cases, it appears that they've simply become criminal gangs. All what this adds up to is the fact that basically the southern Philippines is still extremely lawless, and the government's writ does not run in all parts of the region.
John McLean in Manila. Today, the German Chancellor Helmut Kohl is due to mark the start of construction work on the new German Chancellery building in Berlin in preparation for the government's move from Bonn in 1999. By then, the two houses of parliament, nine government ministries, and more than 18,000 civil servants should have started their move to the German capital. It's one of the most ambitious and expensive government moves ever undertaken. From Berlin, Caroline Wyatt reports.
Berlin, as its residents often complain, has become a building site, nowhere more so than here by the Brandenburg Gate in the former east of the city. Today, the thousands of building workers will be joined by a temporary recruit, the Chancellor himself. In a symbolic ceremony, Helmut Kohl is to dig up the first piece of earth for the construction of the new German Chancellery. Despite delays and heated debate over the cost of the move, the President of the German Parliament, Rita Süssmuth, believes moving to Berlin is the only way to truly unite the country.
It's important when we expect so much from our citizens from Eastern Germany that we are willing to move to Berlin from west to east and that we are very near to the daily problems.
But on the streets of Berlin, there are mixed feelings over the government move.
Ich finde es nicht gut, dass sie kommen. Die wollen dann alles reinigen hier und von dem sogenannten Abschaum, den die...
I really don't want them to come, she's saying. They'll make this place clean and boring. We were a lovely, cozy island before, so let's keep Berlin as it was.
Ja, das kann für Berlin nur gut sein. Die Industrie ist abgewandert, viele Arbeitsplätze sind verloren gegangen.
This gentleman thinks it's a good thing for Berlin. The government will bring jobs and industry with it, and Berlin needs all that.
If some Berliners are reluctant to welcome Bonners to the capital, the feeling is entirely mutual. Many civil servants oppose the move, despite incentives such as free flights back to Bonn at the expense of the beleaguered German taxpayer. So what hope is there of the move uniting the nation? Johannes Gross is the author of a new book on the Berlin Republic.
The idea that Germans have to be alike or that they even have to like each other is a highly artificial concept. Berlin, of course, will be the capital of a federal republic. Munich will remain a capital, as well as Wiesbaden for Hesse, or Mainz for the Palatinate. So it will never become the capital of a centralized state like London is, or Paris, of course, is.
In the light of Germany's history, many of its neighbors will be delighted if not all this nation's political and economic might is gathered in Berlin again. But the signs are that the government's move, now gathering pace, will inevitably change this nation. To pessimists, that could spell a return to Prussian dominance, but the hope is that instead it will lend a greater urgency to tackling the problems of German unity.
Caroline Wyatt reporting from Berlin. The border between Malaysia and Indonesia remains closed after the latest ethnic rioting in the Indonesian province of West Kalimantan. There's been continued tension in the province since last month when clashes began between members of the local Dayak community and Muslim migrants brought in from other parts of Indonesia under a controversial transmigration scheme. The decision of the Malaysian authorities to close the border has left many Indonesian workers stranded on the Malaysian side. Our correspondent in the region is Jonathan Head. I asked him what the latest situation was.
Well, it sounds very tense indeed. There have been clashes going on there since early January between the indigenous people, the Dayaks who live in Kalimantan, and immigrants from other parts of Indonesia. They started after a fight between the two, apparently a row at a pop concert, but they spread very quickly and they've been going on almost since. And it, only last week, a Catholic dormitory in the nearby provincial capital was burnt down in a revenge attack. It seems as though the authorities have failed to get these clashes under control, and the Malaysians are clearly very concerned they could spill over to their side of the border.
And the closure of the border, is that an illustration of how serious the problem has become?
It is, and the Indonesian side is really not reporting what's happening. The authorities on the Indonesian side have been saying repeatedly that things are under control, but people who've been there recently say that simply isn't the case. There are large gangs of young Dayaks with red bandanas on, carrying these traditional long knives they do, and they, in a sense, reverted to their warrior tradition. They're going around from town to town there, attacking the homes of any of these immigrants in the rest of Indonesia they can find. We believe that more than 1,000 homes have been seriously damaged up there. That gives you some idea of the scale of the violence. And given that it's quite a remote area, I think it's very hard for the authorities to control it. They simply don't know where these clashes are going to erupt next.
Jonathan Head reporting from Jakarta. To end the programme, the main points of the news, with half the results in from the general election in Pakistan. The Muslim League, led by Nawaz Sharif, appears to be heading for a comfortable win. The party of the ousted Prime Minister, Benazir Bhutto, is facing one of its worst defeats. A Roman Catholic bishop has been shot dead outside his cathedral in the southern Philippines. And the army in Colombia is sending reinforcements to a jungle area south of the capital, Bogota, where there's been fierce fighting with left-wing guerrillas. On the markets, the Dow Jones closed down 7 at 68.06. In Tokyo, the Nikkei is currently up 228 at 18,314. And the dollar is currently trading at 122.4 Japanese yen and at 1 German mark 64.2. This is Peter Biles in London. From all of us here at Newsday, thanks for listening. Goodbye now.